You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 445. Failure doesn't kill you. It increases your desire to make something happen. Kevin Costner.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Let me ask you a question. How do you get a kick-ass Sundance premiering feature film made? Now, I'm not talking about the sanitized version, but the blood, sweat, tears, and hustle that actually made it happen. The Make Cool Shit podcast documents the making of a certified fresh breakout comedy horror, Scare Me, starring College Humor icon Josh Rubin, The Boys' Aya Cash, and SNL's Chris Redd. This behind-the-scenes look is hosted by Aaron Hayafitz. Join him as he tears down the fourth wall of independent filmmaking. Check out the Make Cool Shit podcast on Spotify or wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Now, guys, today I have a special treat for you. We have legendary film director Kevin Reynolds. Now, Kevin started his career with the classic Fandango, starring an unknown little actor by the name of Kevin Costner. He later created the worldwide box office smash Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, followed up by the misunderstood Waterworld, which many people think was the biggest bomb of all time, but it actually was very far from it and became one of the most profitable IPs in the Universal Studios library. And he was responsible for directing one of my favorite films of all time, The Count of Monte Cristo, among many other films he has directed. Now, it was an absolute joy and honor talking to Kevin because we got into the weeds about one of my favorite films growing up, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, as well as Waterworld, Count of Monte Cristo, how he got his start with his short film Proof, and how he came up with the story for the 1980s classic Red Dawn. We also discussed politics on set, a lot of the stuff that goes behind the scenes of directing one of the biggest hits of the 90s, as well as one of the biggest perceived bombs of the 90s, and so much more. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Kevin Reynolds. I'd like to welcome the show, Kevin Reynolds. Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
I am a big fan of your work for many, many years. Some of your films, specifically in the late 80s and early 90s, had very big impact on my life because I was working at a video store back then. I remember putting together the standee for Robin Hood.
Oh, wow. You're dating yourself, Alex.
I am. Well, the gray hairs date me more and more every day.
Yeah.
So before we get started, how did you get into the business?
Well, that's a bit of a long story, but originally I was a lawyer. I always loved film. What I really liked was to write. I wrote since I was like a kid. But a career in the film business just seemed too far-fetched. So I followed a responsible career path and went to law school, even though I didn't like it. And I practiced for a couple of years. I was in Austin, University of Texas, which had a fabulous facility. And the nice thing about being a lawyer was I had some money, so I could go in. They had a great facility. I could pay for film. I could do stuff. I could pay to do movies. So that's really where I kind of educated myself initially, was at University of Texas. And while I was there, one of the visiting professors was an old Hollywood director named Edward Dimitrik. Mm-hmm. He was one of the Hollywood 10. And I talked to him and said, look, I think this is really what I want to pursue, because I was practicing the daytime. I was staying up till 2 o'clock at night at UT and working on movies. And after about a year of that, I said, I got to make a decision here. So I talked to him. And I said, I want to go to film school at USC. And he said, why? And I said, well, I want to be a director. And he said, it's the toughest job in the world. And I said, no. I said, I really want to do this. You know, I've been practicing law. I really want to do this. He said, you don't understand. It's the toughest job in the world. He said, you've got a good career here being a lawyer. He said, don't do it. And, you know, I said, no, I want to. So anyway, he gave me a letter of introduction. I flew out and met Mort Zarkoff, who's the chairman. And I applied and I got accepted. And the next day I quit my job. Oof. And and like a month later, I packed everything up in a car and moved to LA and started film school. I had like $3,000 to my name. And it was, you know, taking a big chance. And I was there for 2 years. Loved every minute of it. I realized this is really what I'm meant to do. It was 24/7 for 2 years.
What did your parents say? I don't mean to interrupt you, but what did your parents say?
I'll never forget the look on their faces as I got in my car, you know, to drive away to LA. You know, but they didn't say, no, you can't do this. They were just deeply concerned, as well they should be, you know, as I would have been, you know, with my kid. Anyway, so I get there, like I said, for 2 years. It was great. Worked on movies. My goal was to leave USC and have a screenplay I could sell and a movie I could show people. So at the end of the 2 years, I was very fortunate. I got to do what's called a 580, which was the highest level of film at USC. And it was this little movie called Proof. And at the same time, I was writing my thesis screenplay with something called 10 Soldiers, which ultimately became the movie Red Dawn. And I finished the film. And the next week, I got really lucky. I met this guy who I'd known at UT. He was working as an agent at William Morris on somebody's desk. And he'd just been promoted to agent. So he read my script and said, sure, I'll represent you. And I was his first client. His name's Mike Simpson. We're like best friends. Anyway, and so I said, hey, would you send this movie, see if you can send it to Steven Spielberg? He said, okay. So like 2 weeks later, I'm still at USC, and I'm out in the courtyard, and one day, and Mort Zarkoff comes out in the courtyard, and he goes, can you come here? And I walk in his office, he puts his arm around me, he goes, Steven Spielberg's office is on the phone. They want to talk to you. I'm like, okay. So it was Kathy Kennedy. And she goes, Steven watched your movie and he really liked it and he'd like you to come in and talk to him. I think I can find time for that. So I went in the next day and met with Steven. He couldn't have been nicer. He was in the midst of shooting E.T. at the time. And we talked for a long time and I went back to my crappy little apartment in Studio City. And the next day I get this phone call from Kathy Kennedy and she goes, hi, Steven's making arrangements for you to expand your student film into a feature.
Oh, my God.
Okay. So I just sat in the chair for like a half an hour, and I picked up and I called her back and I said, could you say that again? I did not believe her. She just laughed. And he did. He went to Warner's and got him to make what became Fandango. And it was the expanded version of that short film at USC, Proof. And that plus selling my script that became Red Dawn, that's how I got started. It was, things like that don't really happen.
No, you are – that is a man, that is a lottery ticket. That is a lottery ticket times two, because you sold your first script out of film school, and a short film you made got the eye of Steven Spielberg, arguably the biggest, at that time, easily the biggest director in the world, now one of the most legendary directors in the world. And he calls you out of film school. Hey, can you come at me? I mean, it's an insane story. I mean, I'd heard this story a little bit, because I love hearing these kind of origin stories of, you know, of accomplished directors. But this is, you know, and this is, I think, what people hold on to so much sometimes. Film directors hope for this, and it doesn't happen.
Myself, I couldn't believe it. It's like, how could this happen? I never expected to be that fortunate. And, you know, my whole philosophy about success in the film business, I guess in any business, is it's about a third talent, and it's about a third hard work, and it's about a third luck, and not necessarily in that order.
So, yes.
I was extremely lucky.
Now, going back to your short film Proof, which I saw, by the way, and it was fantastic. I found it on YouTube.
Oh, wow.
I found it on YouTube, and I'll put links to it in the show notes so people can see it. There was like this one shot that I was like, how did you get the camera in the cockpit to look up at the pilot? Like, cause the cameras were not that small back then.
No.
So it must've been interesting how you did that.
I'm not sure which shot you're referring to, but I mean, we were shooting 16 millimeter. And so,
you might have had that little, like a little Bolex or something like that. Right. Probably.
It's a smaller camera, but I mean, if it was on Truman, the pilot was probably, you know, it was not, it was a sync camera. So it was a little bit bigger, but I mean, we broke all the rules.
Oh, made. Completely. It was insane. Yeah. It's an insane – look, for people to understand, it's about a bunch of friends taking another friend of theirs to go skydiving for the first time. And it's – I mean, that's a pretty risque short film on a danger level.
There were several times when you know, we were lucky nobody died. It was one of those kind of deals. I mean, the guy who was my production manager, who, you know, I was very close to at the time, he was a pilot. You know, he was 21 years old and he was a pilot. So we would go out in the desert outside of Lancaster, California, in this old airfield. And he would go and rent a plane each weekend. We'd drive up there. We stayed in a Winnebago. And he would go over and rent a plane, not telling them what we were doing with it. And we would fly it, and he would land it on this dirt strip. And we would paint the plane. You know, we would spend half a day painting this plane, taking the seats and stuff out so that it looks like Truman's plane. And then we would shoot all weekend. And then, like, on Sunday night, we'd have to put all the stuff back in the plane, wash it. And then he'd have to fly it back to this place and turn it in, and we'd never tell him what we were doing with it.
Wow.
And, you know, he was doing stuff like diving down on the location, yeah, shots and stuff, and all illegal. And again, we're very lucky.
It's the insanity of youth, isn't it? It really is. Because I did the dumbest things when I was, you know, teenager in my early 20s, things that you just like, what? I didn't do that, but I did insane things. But let's just, you know, call a spade a spade. You quit your law practice to go to be a film director. So you're not altogether there at that age either.
Right. Is that a fair
statement?
That's a fair statement. And I think one of the problems, especially when you're younger, mm-hmm, you know, you think you're immortal, and especially in a movie, you think nothing bad can happen because this is make-believe. And because we're doing make-believe, you know, all the jeopardy is make-believe too, but it's not. And you forget that. Mm-hmm. So again, we were very lucky.
Now, what was, you know, I always like asking this question. What was the biggest lesson you learned from that first short film? Because that was the first time you directed, really, right?
I had done smaller films at USC, but that was the first big one. They have two levels of film. I don't know what they do now, but it was called 480s and 580s. Mm-hmm. And before you did a 580, you were supposed to have directed a 580. And to do a 480, you were supposed to have worked in a crew position on the short film as either an editor or production manager or something, cameraman. And they gave me a waiver. They gave me a waiver and let me go ahead and direct a 580, having only edited a 480. Again, I was very lucky. But they liked the script, the USC. And I mean, that was such an amazing place to go to school. Again, I don't know what it's like now, but it was just, I learned so much there. I still remember when I first went to see Mort Zarkov, and I'm sitting there in his office, and he's telling me, you know, all the classes you have to take, and you were supposed to start out shooting these non-sync little movies. And I was trying to get him to waive me and let me just skip those and go on to the next level of film and stuff. And I'm talking to him, and he just stops me, and he goes, look, he says, we'll teach you how to make movies here. He said, we want people that have something to say. And that's always stuck with me. And I realized finally that the strange collection of personalities that were going to school there, they were all from all different walks of life. I was an attorney. There were people that had been doctors and stuff. And for whatever reason, they just looked at their resumes and said, this person might have something to say. And their whole attitude is, we'll teach you the technical side, which they did. But then once you got there, you had to figure out how to have the wherewithal to say it. In other words, you had to be able to work the system to make your movie. And it was so frustrating at the time because you're competing with all these other people with limited resources and limited slots for the movies that were allowed and stuff. And when you get out, you finally realize it's the studio system. What they're teaching you is the studio system, that you have to fight other people and you have to battle other potential filmmakers for those slots. And you learn all the tricks, you know, like every weekend when you're making a student film, you had to sign up for equipment out of the equipment room. And it was always limited. You know, you couldn't always get the cameras you wanted or the grip gear and stuff like that. So I figured, OK, well, here's what I'm going to do. For my cameraman, I hired the guy that ran the equipment room.
Smart.
So we got whatever we wanted. And it's just stuff like that that you learn. Okay, this is how you have to work the system to get what you want. And it goes beyond film school. It goes on to professionally too. And to me, that was, you know, the most important thing I think I learned at USC was how to game the system.
A very useful skill in Hollywood, to say the least.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, how did you come up with the idea for Red Dawn? Because that was a pretty awesome idea. Just the concept was it's very cool.
Yeah, the original, it was titled 10 Soldiers, T-E-N. And, you know, I did it for the not only the fact there were 10 people involved, but I also like the idea of 10, T-I-N, soldiers as well. But I don't know. I don't really know where it came from. I think at the time what it was in the early 80s, we were, you know, there was a lot of drum beating against the Russians and stuff. And people were going, oh, let's go to war with the Ruskies. And I thought, how stupid. And people didn't understand why the Europeans weren't behind us and stuff. And I was like, well, the reason is because they just had a horrible war about 40 years ago and they know what it's like. And, you know, it'd been over 100 years since Americans had had a war in our own backyards. And so we were sort of removed from that experience. And I thought, okay, what would it be like if we actually had to fight a war on our own turf? What would it be like for people to really have to go through that, to fight a guerrilla war like they did in World War II in Europe? And that was really the genesis for the screenplay, where the idea came from. And so I sort of incorporated that into what was going on at the time with the Russians and all, and it came out the way it did. You know, John Milius took it and I think he made it a little more jingoistic. I don't think he did. He did. He made it more jingoistic than what I intended it to be. What I wrote was more like Lord of the Flies. And John was trying to make more of a political statement. And I just wanted to show, this is what war does to people. This is what it would do to you if it happened here. Anyway.
Yes, John has that, does that with his films, to say the least. God bless him, man. God bless him. Now, when you were doing your first feature, Fandango, you hired a little unknown actor at that time. I think Kevin something or other. I don't even know if he's doing anything anymore. Mr. Costner, Kevin Costner, you hired him. And he actually has become, in your career, a collaborator for a lot of big films that you worked on. How was it working with like putting Fandango together? And because I remember watching Fandango, there's such a youthful energy. It's created by young filmmakers, acted by young filmmakers, and you can sense that energy there. How was it like putting that whole thing together and also having Big Daddy Spielberg like in the shadows? Must have been terrifying.
It was an interesting experience. I mean, it was just kind of handed to me. Okay, go make this movie. But I knew it had to be an expanded version of Proof. So I had to write a movie backwards. I had to.
Right.
How do I take this one sequence and make an entire feature around it? And I mean, unfortunately, I think Steven expected it to be more like Animal House, which is sort of the quality, a little bit of Proof. But I guess at the time I wanted to do something a little more soulful. And like so many filmmakers, it was that sort of – my first film was that sort of quintessential coming-of-age story that everybody has to get out of their system before they can move on to something else. And that's sort of where I found myself as I sat down to write it. And I think it was more soulful. Which I don't think was a bad thing, but I think it was not necessarily what some people expected it to be. And as for Costner, I actually met him when I was in film school, because when I was making Proof, he came in and read for the part in the student film. He was the stage manager at Raleigh Studios in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. He was sweeping floors trying to get gigs as an actor, and he came in and read for the part, and I really liked him, but I cast somebody else. As you can see in Proof. But I called him and I said, look, man, I'm sorry. I thought you were great. I really liked you, but I don't know why. I've cast this other guy. And he was, very gracious and thanked me and all. And then like a couple years later, when we were actually making Fandango and casting it, he came in again to read for it. And we remembered each other and we talked and, I remembered him very well. And he sat down to read for the part of Gardner Barnes, and literally within the first two lines out of his mouth, I knew he was the guy. And
did he switch? Did he switch something from 2 years earlier? What made the difference?
I don't know what it was. It was just, I don't know if in those couple of years, he'd done a couple of smaller parts. He was, cutting The Big Chill and stuff. But
he was in that, if I remember correctly, he was a dancing extra in Night Shift, Ron Howard's Night Shift.
He was. He was, but there was just, he had the quality of the character. And I think it was more he had the quality of the character in the expanded version, because Gardner Barnes and Fandango is a much more complete character with a much deeper arc than the character in the short. And maybe that's what it was that the character himself had changed a lot in those 2 years. And he just fit him. And that's when I cast him.
Now, when you're going into a film, what is your pre-production process? I mean, do you rehearse with actors? Because I know some directors love long rehearsals. Other directors want it on the day. What's your pre-production process?
It's evolved over the years. And for me personally, when I started out, I would have rehearsals and stuff. And a lot of times it's awkward because people show up, they don't know each other. And ultimately, I've come to realize that for me, the most valuable thing about rehearsal is not so much learning the lines and stuff. It's really getting to know the other people. Mm. It's creating a rapport and a bit of a shorthand before you show up on the set. So you're just not like showing up with strangers. It's really getting to know each other. You'll sit there and you talk about the characters and you explore them and you'll do scenes and stuff. But I think it's ludicrous to expect that whatever performance level you achieved in rehearsal is going to be the same thing you get 2 months later when you're actually doing it on the floor, right? Because things evolve. And that to me is the greatest benefit of rehearsal, is simply getting to know the actors and letting them get to know you. you know, so that you're, there's a familiarity before you start to do it. It's easier to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like about it. Now, there's some actors that really like to rehearse to a T. I respect that. You know, that's what they need. Every actor needs something different. And others hate rehearsal. They don't want to do it. They just want to show up on the day. And I get that too. And I think personally, that's kind of where I am. I prefer to just discuss the characters, maybe try some things, but don't say, okay, that's it. That take right there, the way you played it, that's it. That's how we're going to do it 3 months from now. That's BS. And I've also learned, and performance-wise, on the set, when you're doing a scene, I don't like to rehearse too much before you shoot. I like to block it so everybody kind of knows where you're supposed to go. And you kind of get a loose rhythm. And I encourage people when you're rehearsing on the day of the shoot to not get up to performance level. I just say, let's just loosely block this and figure out where you're going to be. Because invariably what I find is you burn out. And you can spend a couple hours rehearsing something and they'll give you their good stuff. And then it comes time to shoot and they've already given it to you. So I like to hold it back as much as possible until you actually roll cameras. I prefer to rehearse on camera. Because
you never know.
You know, again, every actor is different. Some actors show up and they're just exploding. You know, they've been thinking about it all night and they're ready to go. And within the first three or four takes, they've given you the best stuff. So if you rehearse, you know, 6-8 times, you've lost it. There are other actors that show up and they need a lot of coffee because they're not even remotely there. And it may take them the better part of the day to get up to performance level. They need to do it a lot. And so as a director, you've got to recognize these differences in them. And so the guy that's right there from the get-go, that's who you want to cover first, you know? Mm-hmm. And the guy that's going to build into it, you want him off camera for half the day until you turn around and start to shoot him. It's just, you know, it just comes from experience. It's just, you learn these things about working with people and you have to respect everybody's got their own way. And so you're trying to make all those different ways jive for what you're trying to do.
It's kind of like what the director told you in film school. This is the most difficult job in the world. He was right.
He was, you know, and it's like another thing I tell people, I think 50% of directing is just having the willingness to subject yourself to the process. Mm. Because it's not everybody can do it. And to get through it, you have to want to do it. You really have to want to go through that process. I mean, it, you know, like it's not like combat or anything like that, something horrible, but it's strenuous. It's very strenuous. And you kind of have to put yourself in that place and be willing to run the gauntlet, you know, to get there. Because it is, if you do it right, I think. Mm-hmm. There's some people that just sit back and just let it happen and don't put themselves into it too much. But I think the product is affected by that.
It is not for the weak-hearted, or weak-willed, to say the least. There's so many directors I've known over the years that I've got my start in post-production. So I had directors sitting on my couch while I edited and color graded and did all this stuff. And you see it. You see the personalities, you see, like, this guy ain't gonna make it. This was the, and I've had many directors who got that one shot. They got their Fandango. They got their Fandango, and then they're like, you know what? I'm gonna go back to being a lawyer. This is not for me. And then there's other ones that, like, are just in the mud, and you're like, he's gonna make it, or she's gonna keep going.
it's crazy. It's, you have to be a little crazy. You really do. I don't know why this story, I can digress for a moment.
Sure.
The guy who was my producer on Fandango, Tim Zinnemann, great guy. And Tim had been an AD for a long time. He worked on a lot of shows. And I won't say which show, but he worked on this one in the South Pacific that was just a disaster. Mm-hmm. The Dino De Laurentiis thing. And, you know, the cast was crazy. And he had actors that would show up in Dino's office and rip their clothes off and scream at him and stuff. And anyway, the director was just losing it. And he said, one day, you know, the call was like 7 or something. Everybody shows up and they can't find the director. They're on an island. And they wait and they wait and they wait and can't find him. And Tim finally just starts walking around the island. It's not that big. He's looking for the guy. He's not in his quarters or whatever. Finally, he walks around the island like half an hour, and on the far side of the island, he finally finds this guy sitting in the sand looking through binoculars at crabs.
He lost it. He had lost it.
Just completely lost it. Gone.
Wow. That's like a Terry Gilliam film. Like, that's something I would see.
You know, you just you don't want to get to that place. You have to be stupid enough to think you're right and stupid enough to think, I'm going to power through this. I can do this, you know, and that, you know, if other people can do it, I can do it. Because if you start to doubt yourself, you're dead. You may be wrong, but if you doubt yourself, you're dead.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. So as you're going through your career, your next film, I think, was The Beast, if I remember correctly, which I remember recommending heavily at my video store because no one had heard of it. And I don't think Jason Patrick was a very big star at that point. I mean, he might have just been starting out. But I was like, wow, this is really great. And I got a lot of good comment cards for my recommendation of The Beast, I remember. And as this is going on, Kevin, the other Kevin, Kevin Costner, he's kind of growing as a star, fairly high, to the point where he comes to Dances with Wolves, which, cements him as probably one of the biggest movie stars at the time. You also did a little part in Dances with Wolves. Can you tell me what you did or what you helped with? I mean, from my understand.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, I went out there to the Dakotas for a few weeks and did some second unit. And,
it's not a bad second unit director, I'm going to say.
You know, we knew each other and we talked a lot, you know, Kevin and I, you know, spending a lot of time together. And so he asked me to come out and I did and trying to help him out. And there were rumors, you know, at the time that I was directing the picture.
No,
stuff.
Of course there's always stuff. No,
that wasn't true. But I worked on the Buffalo Hunt and some other stuff. So
that was awesome. And so that kind of cemented him as a very big movie star. And then right afterwards, I think it was the next year or so, were you guys already working on Robin Hood during Dances? Or after Dances, that's when Robin Hood showed up?
Yeah. I was – this was after The Beast, and I'd been on and off a couple of different things that, you know, didn't happen. And I was actually on another picture at Universal. We were in prep, and – They'd asked me to leave another project to come do that. And I was reluctant because I said, look, this is a $40 million picture, which at the time was a lot of money.
Huge.
And they went, no, it's not 40 man. I said, look, it's a $40 million movie. And they said, look, don't worry about it. We're making this movie. Come do it. Anyway, so I did. I bailed and I started doing prep on the other show. We set up a production office and everything. And after about 2 months, finally the budget came in, $39 million. And they go, we're not doing that. And I'm like, I told you it was going to be $40 million. And yeah, well, you got to bring it down to 30 because we're not doing it. I was furious because I'd wasted all this time. Literally the next day, I get this phone call. And they said, hey, you want to do Robin Hood? And little did I know, there were a couple of competing projects out there.
Yes.
One with John McTiernan. So I said, sure. If you're making it, yes. Because I was so angry. So I did. I bailed and went the next day and said, I'm out of here. And so I went on to this other Robin Hood. And the next day after I got onto that, I get this call from Kevin and he goes, can I talk to you? And I said, sure. He says, come on over. So he comes over to my new office and he walks in and he goes, did you know I was on this other Robin Hood with McTiernan? And I went, no. I said, are you serious? He goes, yeah. He said, you know, we were talking about doing this other thing. And I said, I had no idea. And he was like, oh, God, okay, well, whatever. Long story short, the producer, who was very wily, realized Costner was doing this. So he asked me to do the Robin Hood. And so Kevin bailed on the other one and came on to that Robin Hood. And that's how it came to be.
Yeah, there was a couple. I remember it always happens. Like there's the asteroid movies where there's competing asteroid movies and the Robin Hoods and the volcano movies.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, and that's happened a couple of times to me. And in fact, just recently, I don't know why I had this idea. I thought, God, you know, an interesting subject for a film would be Audie Murphy. And so I read a couple of books on him and stuff. And I was like, God, this would be an interesting story. Literally, the next day I read this thing in the trades that somebody was doing an Audie Murphy series based on my. How
did that happen? So I had Penn Desham on the show as well, who is the writer of Robin Hood for everybody in the audience. And Penn is just one of the sweetest human beings I've ever met. I absolutely adore Penn. And I told him the same story I'm going to tell you. I was working on the weekends in movie theaters. So I was working weekdays at a video store, working weekends at a movie theater. I was definitely glutton for punishment. And that year, 91 comes out, Robin Hood. Me and my friend went to go see it, sat in the front row because it was packed. You couldn't get anything else. Looking up at it, got out, walked right back in and watched it again. It was we were so enthralled with that movie. And it was so much fun. And it was just like such a fun movie. And I have to ask you, like, you're taking on a character like Robin Hood, which is a beloved character, you know, obviously the Errol Flynn thing from years ago. And he's just such a well-known character. And I know from what I understood, I've done research on that movie years ago, Kevin did not want to wear tights. He's like, I'm not wearing tights in this movie. So you can forget that. How do you approach a character, such an iconic character? And did you feel any just pressure by tackling that kind of character?
Yeah. All in. Yes. You know, I just plunged into that one because I wanted to make a picture. Like I said, I'd been on and off a couple of things. And finally, I was just like, okay, is this going? Is this for real? I'm in. And, you know, I read the script and I liked the idea of it. I wanted to do some things with it. And, yeah, one of the problems was, how do we make this not, you know, look ridiculous? Like,
right.
and I'll tell you a couple other things. But first off, when we're 2 weeks from shooting and the wardrobe guy, you know, is working on it and he wouldn't show me anything. And I'm finally, look, I gotta see what you're thinking about. And so he's like, okay, come tomorrow afternoon. I'll have it laid out. So I go into the warehouse where he's working and he lays all this stuff on the table and it's literally like, you know, green tights and the little scallop thing like this, a little green hat.
Oh my God. So it's Errol Flynn.
Yeah. And I look at him and I'm like, this is a joke, right? Where's the real stuff? And I could tell from the look on his face, no, this was it. This was the wardrobe.
Oh my God.
And I was horrified. So I fired him.
I, as you should, sir.
And I hired John Bloomfield. And John, literally, he came in with less than 2 weeks and created an amazing wardrobe. John was a genius. I mean, he saved us. You know, he came in, he did something that was classy, you know, that really worked. And I mean, hats off to John because we were in dire straits, you know, and he did that. On the movie itself, I don't know what it was about it, but it, you know, as I was reading it, something didn't quite, it wasn't enough. And as I started to explore the characters and I was trying to find something that would get me excited, I realized I didn't want to take things too seriously in places. And consequently, the sheriff evolved the way that he did. And it was great because when I met Alan Rickman, we were both on the same page that he, you know, he didn't want to play him as some mustache twirling villain. He wanted to do something different too. And we just completely clicked in that regard. And I think that, you know, that was a lot of what made the picture work was Alan, you know, and that was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, he was fresh off of that other independent film called Die Hard, where he played another amazing villain. So he started that, you know, you went right from, I don't know if he did anything in between, but then Die Hard and then Sheriff of Nottingham. It's just like, I mean, he steals. I mean, I don't want to say steals every scene, but he just eats up every scene he's in.
Yeah, he did. It was fun. It was fun because I'd say, what if you do this? And he goes, okay, but then what if I do this? You know, and it just kept building on itself. And it was fortuitous.
Without question. And then you have Morgan Freeman, who's not a slouch. It was good times. Now that film comes out and explodes. I mean, it was a huge, huge hit that summer, if I remember correctly. It's a massive, massive hit, and really, you know, Kevin is on a, you know, Dances with Wolves, Robin Hood, and then I think the next picture is your next picture, Waterworld, right after that.
No, I went off with Rapa Nui.
That's right. I'm sorry. I thought that was after. Yes. So Rapa Nui. So yeah, after the success of Robin Hood, you went, what attracted you to that story? Because that's such, and it was so beautiful. And it's such a, I never even heard of that story. It was such a great
Nobody had. And that was what attracted me to it, was just, I'd done some reading about Easter Island and, you know, what happened there so long ago. From what they understand, you know, they think that Polynesians landed there about the 5th century AD, and they think they were probably Marquesas. They were fleeing political strife there, and they came, probably a couple dozen people landed there. And they were led by a guy named Hotu Matua. And over the centuries, they populated the island, and it's the most isolated island on the face of the earth, populated island. It's 2,300 miles west of Chile, 1,500 miles east of Pitcairn Island. And they lived there, you know, for centuries without any contact that we know of from anywhere else. So I was fascinated by the fact that what they know is that it wasn't even discovered again until 1722 by a Dutch navigator on Easter Sunday. And that's where the name came from, Easter Island. But what they found at the time was it's just a barren place, no trees, and all these toppled statues and these people living in caves in the ground, just almost like animals. And I'm like, how did that happen? You know, nobody could understand. But what they came to realize historically from their oral history was these descendants of Hotu Matua populated the island. They divided ultimately into two different clans, the long ears, who were kind of nobility, and the short ears, who were the commoners. And they basically degraded the island environmentally. They cut all the trees down. They overfished it. They overpopulated it. They think at one time there were 20,000 people on this little 8-by-11-mile island.
Oh, wow.
And they ultimately fell into internecine warfare. And, you know, the short ears killed most of the long ears. And there's this one guy named Oroña who's supposed to be the descendant of the long ears who survived. And, they had this huge statue building cult. Nobody could understand really why did they build them so big. There was statue building throughout Polynesia, but nobody could understand why they did them so big there. But they cut down all these trees and cut all these statues out of these craters and rolled them around the island and erected them. There are hundreds of them. Mm-hmm. In each little community. They're called Moai. So my story, what I wanted to do was try to explore why did they do this? And what is it about human beings that no matter where we are on the planet, there's something inherent in us that makes us destroy ourselves environmentally?
Right.
You take this isolated group of humanity without any outside influence, and they did it to themselves. So that's kind of what I wanted to explore in the story. You know, and coming off of Robin Hood and being hot and thinking I could do anything and, you know, I could overcome any obstacle, I decided, oh, we'll go to Easter Island and shoot this. It's the hardest movie I ever made.
Wait a minute. Was Rapa Nui is the hardest movie you ever made?
Yeah.
That's in your filmography, sir. That is a statement and a half.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. Cause I saw it. I was like, I wonder if they shot this. I mean, it looks like they shot this on Easter Island. And I'm like, you were crazy enough to go shoot this on Easter Island.
Yeah, we were. There's so many stories. I won't bore you with it, but it was nuts.
It was insane, but it's beautiful, and it has that Kevin Reynolds kind of style to it that you carry throughout your filmography, and I think it's, and I remember it coming out, and it did. I mean, obviously, it didn't do well.
It bombed. It did nothing.
It wasn't as successful as Robin Hood. That's a fair statement.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, really, it just like, was it because of lack of, you know, cause you didn't have any major stars in. I mean, Jason Scott Lee was just off of, Dragon, right? Or was it before Dragon?
Yeah. And Isai Morales. And yeah, it was a cast of relative unknowns, but I mean, you know, we had to do it that way to try to cast people that look like Rapanuians. And another part of the problem is the vast majority of the public has no idea what happened on Easter Island. I mean, we would show it at screenings and people would ask, well, where is this place? And like, what century was this? And, you know, they had no concept of what we were trying to portray. It could have been on Mars for all they knew. They just didn't grasp it at all. And I think in a lot of ways the picture just simply didn't work. You know, it didn't translate from screenplay to screen the way I'd hoped it would. It's the most, in some ways, I think it was the island itself, because that's the most haunted place I've ever been to.
Really?
It's almost like the island didn't want us to tell the story. It was, I know it sounds ridiculous.
No, I get you.
It's a creepy place.
I mean, God knows what happened in that island. I mean, God knows what kind of,
A lot of bad things. A lot of really bad. You can just feel there's a malevolence there that I've never felt anywhere else. And
I'll tell you what. Go ahead. I actually, when I went to New York last year, I hadn't been to New York in probably a decade. I went to Ground Zero, and when I literally walking onto Ground Zero, you could just feel. I mean, I don't want to get hokey pokey on everybody here, but you felt something. There's definitely a heaviness there. So I can imagine that's kind of like, it's the only thing I can equate it to.
Well, you have to realize these people were isolated. They had no concept about what was out there. To me, it was like our concept about where we are in space, because they had to wonder what's out there. They've been so isolated for 100 years. They had no idea what was in the rest of the world. You know, and so they conjured up these notions themselves and this religion that they had. And I remember one day there was a guy who was had worked with Jacques Cousteau, and he lived there on the island. He'd married a Rapa Nui girl. And one day he was taking me around on a tour. We went up to one end of it called the Poiki Peninsula, and the whole place is like an open archaeological site. But we just pulled off the road near where we'd been shooting recently. And he said, come here, I want to show you something. We walk over and he just lifts this rock off the ground. And there's a hole about this big. He says, come on. So he gets a lamp and we just crawl down in this hole, probably about 15 feet down. And I'm like, where are we going? And it's just so tight. And finally we get down there to the bottom and crawl into this chamber that opens up, and he shines this light. And there are 20 human skeletons in there. And it's like this family place where people had buried their dead, you know, for centuries.
Wow.
And he knew, and the islanders knew it was there, but you're not even aware that it's like everywhere. And
because there's nowhere else to go. Like, you're not shipping this off somewhere.
Nowhere else to go. And I remember the first time I went, I mean, well before shooting, a couple years before, just explore the place, and there were no rules, and you could just walk all over it. I mean, you'd walk up to the Ahu, which are the platforms that the Moai sat on, and you'd look down inside, and there'd be human bones and stuff. And there are no paved roads, so we hired a Jeep, and we're driving around. When we hired the Jeep, you know, from the guy, and he says, when are you going to bring it back? And I go, tomorrow. And he goes, okay, we'll just park it there and leave the keys in it. And I'm like, well, what if somebody steals it? And he goes, where are they going to take it?
Like, it's
a good point.
What is it, 8 miles by 10 miles?
Exactly. And so,
that's hilarious. So we're
driving around the island off road, come to this amazing Ahu, look inside, and it's stunning. You could walk up and there are all these human bones. And being the asshole that I was, I took this little piece of bone.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It's like the Brady Bunch. It's like the Brady Bunch episode when they took the totem and now all the bad luck starts happening to them.
The next, and we get over to the other side of the island later that day, and we come over this rise, and it's, you know, it's like windy and stuff. We're the only people there. There's nobody around us. And we come over and we're trying to get to this other giant ahu, and you know, it's amazing. But as soon as we come over this hill and down the hill, everything goes still. There's no sound. All the insects stop. The wind stops. You can see the ocean, and it's like a mill pond. It's completely calm. It's just like creepy. When we get out, we're walking around, and I'm looking around this ahu, and out the corner of my eye, I look up and I see something like a figure, something dropped down behind this ahu. And I'm like, what was that? And I walk around behind it. There's nothing there. Was it a dog? What was it? But this chill just went up my spine. So I said, my buddy that I'm with, my agent, Mike, and I said, let's get out of here. So we get back in the Jeep and we drive away. And as we go back over the hill, all the sound starts again. The wind comes up. The insects start.
Wow.
We get back to town in this little place that we're staying that night, the hotel, you know, it's after dinner. We're talking to the lady that runs the place and describing our day. And I tell her about this, you know, what had happened. And she goes, when I finished, did you take anything?
Did you take anything?
I said, yeah. And she goes, put it back. And she explained to me that every month, they would get packages from all over the world sent by people who'd taken things that said, I took this rock or I took this bone, and ever since I did, terrible things have been happening to me, and I know it's because I took this. And the Polynesians have this thing called mana, which is this power that exists in things, and they believe in it. And I thought it was just BS. And this is why I'm telling you, it's the most haunted place I've ever been to. So, yeah, I put it back.
So it was literally the Brady Bunch episode when they took the toad.
I've never seen that, but I it must be.
Yeah, they had, it was Hawaii. They took a totem, and then they start, all this bad stuff started happening to them. Right. Wow, I'd heard of stories like that in Hawaii. Even like you take a rock and you anger the Hawaiian gods. Yeah,
there too. Yeah,
yeah, it's really wow. I'm glad I didn't take any rocks when I was in Hawaii. after Rapa Nui. That, you know, because of the massive success of Rapa Nui, they decided to give you one of the most expensive movies ever made. Because Hollywood knows what they're doing, apparently. They're like, you know, this – no, I'm joking. But you get onto Waterworld, and how did that whole project come together? Was that Kevin leading the charge? Did you lead the charge? How did that whole thing get together?
Well, Kevin and I weren't getting along after Robin Hood. I won't even get into it, but we weren't. And so somebody sent me the script, and I really liked it. And it was Larry Gordon, who at the time was the head of Fox. And he asked me to come in and talk to him, and I did. And sat there, and I was telling him, yeah, I really like this. You know, I think it's a really cool script, this Peter Rader script.
Yeah.
And Larry goes, well, there's a huge movie star that's really interested in it, too. Really wants to do this. I'm like, oh, yeah? Who's that? And he goes, Kevin Costner. I'm like, I don't know if I want to do that. And anyway, long story short, Larry gets us back together again. And we agreed to do it. And that was
the beginning.
You've heard all the stories. You know.
No, I know. I mean, everyone's heard the stories of you know, the legendary stories of Waterworld, and I've had Peter on the show as well. So I heard a lot of stuff from his point of view. He was like, Alex, I was on set for 2 or 3 days. I don't know, you know, however long he was, a week or two or whatever. He goes, I just got to sit and watch some of the stuff. But again, just like Easter Island, like, hey, let's go shoot on Easter Island. You said, hey, let's go shoot this in the ocean, which. I get it, makes sense, but I guess you underestimated the power of nature and everything. How what was that like being in the middle of that storm, literally and figuratively?
Yeah, it's you know, when I first decided that, again, you're still in that mode as a young filmmaker, like I can overcome anything. Mm-hmm. Anything you throw at me, I'll figure it out and I'll make it work. But I called Steven Spielberg. When I decided I want to do this, and I asked him, I said, look, there's a project Waterworld. It's all set on the ocean. And, you know, you did Jaws. And do I really want to do this? And he goes, you may. He said, I would never work on the water again. And I'm like, okay. And, you know, I didn't heed his advice. And I went and saw Sid Sheinberg, who was the head of Universal, who did the show. And I'm talking to him, and I'm like, you know, we're talking about the budget and all this stuff. And I go, Sid, you know, we're going to be responsible and stuff. But, you know, I was talking to Steven, and Steven tells me that the original schedule on Jaws was 55 days, and they ended up shooting 155 days. And Sid just sits there for a second. He goes, I don't remember the schedule, but I do know they went 100% over budget.
Wow.
I'm like, okay. And so I hope you remember that. He goes, oh, I do. And they were aware of the, you know, the problem, dangers of what could happen shooting on the water. And the thing that annoys me about people that, you know, criticize the movie and stuff is they, you know, there a lot of people felt like we were just being profligate, that we just went out there and we were just, you know, all sitting around eating bonbons and drinking, you know, pina coladas, and we weren't. It was very tough. You know, yes, we were, you know, very well taken care of, but it was a very, very difficult picture. But anybody that shoots on the water like that is going to encounter it. And consequently, you know, 25 years later, that's why people do CGI. I don't know if people will ever do something like that again, because so much of what we did was in camera. It was not CGI. And you just don't appreciate the difficulty. It's just stuff you take for granted where, you know, you set up a shot, you've got a camera boat, you've got somebody on a boat in front of you, and then you've got background boats. You've got a horizon behind, because you're always having to shoot so that you've got a clean horizon to maintain the notion that, you know, there's no land. So we picked the west coast of the Big Island of Hawaii, where there was like 160 degree view out to open water, relatively little traffic. That's where we chose to shoot. But when you set up a shot that looks very simple in the film, like I was just describing, you don't realize that they're currents. And so you set the camera up and your subject boat here in the background, they're all drifting differently. So you can't hold a frame. So it's ever to try to move things back into frame just to hold the frame. Ultimately, there were times where if the currents were really bad, you can't turn and shoot towards land. You always have to shoot out toward the water. And sometimes the sun would be low and it's looking right. You're looking right into the sun. So you have to find all these variations for how you can get around that. There were times where we'd have to send divers down, attach a line to the boat we're trying to shoot, anchor it to the bottom on a pulley where they could move it and pull it to try to maintain some control over the boat that was in front of camera. And so when you see it on film, you go, it's a big deal. Yeah, it's a boat and there's some background behind it. You don't realize what it took to do something that would be relatively simple on land to do it on water like that. And every day was like that. Every day.
And everything you just described could be done in about 5 or 10 minutes. It doesn't take a long time to send the divers down, lock in the boat, you control, you know, it just what when you're talking about Steven and Jaws, I mean, he had one boat and a mechanical shark. You had like a floating city, and it seemed to me, I know it wasn't hundreds, but it seemed like, you know, 20, 30, 40 support vehicles, whether it be, you know, land, water skis or boats, or it was what Peter said. It's Mad Max on the water.
We had a Navy. Wow. We had a whole department that did nothing but run boats. I mean, you think about it. We had this atoll was anchored about a mile offshore outside of a harbor called Kauaiha. Literally the big floating atoll. And there were multiple lines from that went down to the bottom. It was about 100 feet deep. And they anchored it on the bottom. They had to. Otherwise, it would drift away. And it would rotate on those lines. But when you go out there, when you're doing a big scene like a battle scene where you've got hundreds of extras and you've got special effects and stuff, you don't realize, okay, you've got a whole barge that's nothing but porta potties, you know? And so you get up in the morning, you have to run all those people through wardrobe. You have to feed them. have to put them on boats and ferry them out to the atoll, get them in position for whatever shots you're doing. And then once you shoot for a little bit, it's lunchtime. And so then you have to ferry all those people back into shore to feed them and then go back out for the afternoon. And that's it's just incredibly cumbersome.
I'm just baffled that the studio agreed to go down this road. I mean, everybody knew. Like, there's no way you can make a day. Did you ever make a day? Like, it's out of your control.
A few times, yeah. But I think our original schedule was, I think we finally agreed on like maybe 120 days. And I think ultimately we shot 170 days.
Jesus, that's actually impressive that you got it.
So, I mean, you know, I defy anybody else to, you know, overcome it and do what I think we did. It was tough. Like I said, and most of it's in camera. Yes, there are effects in the show, but most of what you see was shot in camera.
And I heard, and if I remember correctly, was there a hurricane that destroyed a whole bunch of sets or something happened like that?
You know, that was the rumor that the whole atoll sunk. Uh-huh. That's not true. Yes, oh, okay. we had an earthquake off the coast of Japan once one morning. We had to like move everybody inshore up high because we didn't know if there was going to be a tsunami or not. It never happened.
Thank God.
We lost another half day just on that. But the thing that did sink, there's one sequence where the Mariner approaches. It looks like this big. Oh, I don't know. It's like a big mushroom sticking up out of the water. It's a trading post. And the Smokers and Dennis Hopper have arrived there and they've killed everybody and they've rigged their arms to wave and stuff. And we shot that. That sank. But it was not the atoll.
Okay. So, all right. So I remember at that time that the press and the town crucified the movie before a frame of it was even shown to people. You were being... I mean, it was, and I remember being, I was there. I remember just from a distance looking at it and going, my God, they're pounding on poor Kevin Reynolds on this. Like, so how do you direct? Because I'm assuming you were aware of this.
Oh, yeah.
So how do you direct? How do you deal with that kind of stress?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. Now back to the show.
It's very difficult. It's my least favorite kind of filmmaking because there's so many forces working on you. You really can't be flexible because when you have a shooting day that costs $300,000, you know, you can't change your mind about things. You have to kind of stick with the plan, even if you get on set and go, well, that doesn't work that well. But if we change that, we lose a half a day and we can't afford to do that again. So you can't be flexible. And you've got all these people looking over your shoulder, you know, and I understand because it's a hell of a lot of money, but it's not a fun way to work. It's not a fun way to work. I'll tell you one story that kind of summed up the whole press thing for me. Cause we had, you know, guys would show up in speedboats and try to come by and shoot it and stuff and all these inflammatory things and exaggerations. One day we were shooting a sequence outside the harbor on the catamaran, and I had the camera guys up on the mast of it about 40 feet up, two guys, and I was trying to do a shot where you're looking down on the activity down below and then tilt up to the horizon. And we're anchored offshore, and the swell comes up, and the catamaran starts kind of going like this. And I look over, and the mast is kind of bending a little bit like that. And so I turn to the boatmaster, and I said, Bruno, is this safe? And he looks up at it and goes, no. Okay, well, we have to wrap out of this and go inside because we can't have these two guys fall off here. So we did. We had to wrap, go back inside the harbor, shoot something else, lose another half day. Okay, the next day, our publicist gets phone from the States, some journalist who goes, okay, I've had this confirmed by two sources, so don't lie to me. I want you to tell me about the two camera guys that were killed in the accident yesterday. He goes, what? He goes, don't lie to us. We know this happened and you guys are covering up. So tell us the truth. we know you lost two people in an accident yesterday. And he's, it didn't happen. That was the kind of stuff that went on.
Oh my God. I can't look, directing a film is arguably one of the most stressful things a human being can do. And again, war and all of that, I understand. But in the creative arts, absolutely one of the most difficult things you can do.
Right.
Working in Hollywood in the studio system is probably one of the most difficult things you can do. Working with $150, $175 million budget on your shoulders and the stress of that is one of the most difficult things you can do. And then having to deal with that kind of lunacy. I mean, you must have – it's kind of like a presidency, like when you see one come in and then 4 years later, 8 years later, they've aged 50 years. I'd have to imagine that that happened to you at the end of this process.
It does. It does. And it changes you, you know. It really changes you and your outlook and all. And, you know, after that, I don't really like those kind of movies, to be honest. They're not fun. They're just not fun. And
the making of them or the kind of story of, or the storytelling aspect of it?
The story is interesting, but the making of them is so difficult and it's not as organic. I prefer smaller pictures where you have more control. Mm-hmm. You can be more flexible than big ones like that. I mean, you still see it today. I mean, all these big superhero movies and stuff, they're very much like that, you know.
But it's all CG. But it's a lot of CG now.
It's all CG, but it's still it's hundreds of millions of dollars and it's filmmaking by committee. Mm-hmm. And it's just not that organic. Some people thrive on that and they like it. I'm not one of those people. I prefer to do smaller things where it's more your domain.
So the movie comes out and everyone's like, it's the biggest bomb in history and all this stuff, which was such, you know, for to use a term of our time, fake news, because it ended up actually doing well, and then I was talking to Peter, and he said it's one of the most valuable IPs and profitable IPs in the entire catalog of Universal Studios.
Right.
So do you feel a little vindicated?
Yeah. I mean, I look at some – there are pictures that were much – people lost – they lost a lot more money than Waterworld. It's just once you sort of get tainted with
– Oh, yeah.
You know, you can't lose that. It's very difficult. I mean, Hollywood, it's more interesting that something's controversial and it's going bad than to hear that everything's going well. That's boring.
It's more interesting, of course.
It's more interesting. And so they thrive on that. And somebody told me the first time they screened a picture in New York or something for critics and they walked out and this one critic was so disappointed and he goes, well, it didn't suck. And that was his comment.
Right. Like they wanted it to be the worst.
It's so play. Be horrible.
And he was really disappointed. He's disappointed that it was it's not as bad as I thought it would be. Right. I watched it when I watched it again recently. It's fun. It's just a fun film. It's just a good adventure film. Dennis Hopper, again, chews up the scenery.
You're being kind. I mean, there are a lot of problems with the movie.
I know. But you got to – I know. I understand. Look, but it's – enjoy. I enjoyed it. It is an enjoyable film. And it's just a good, fun adventure adventure film. But it is one of those films that is historically, you know, tainted. But the truth – and that's what I try to do even in my little way with Peter's interview and now with yours. I'm like, no, it's arguably one of the most profitable – IPs that they have. And I think they're working. I know you can't say yay or nay, but I heard they're working on trying to do something new with it because it's a great IP.
I don't know if they're going to do another picture or not. You know, they made a fortune off the ride.
Oh, yeah.
It's been going for 25 years now.
It's still there. I've seen that show probably 3, 4, 5 times and maybe more in my life. And it's still going. I have to ask you because you've had both. You've had extreme highs in this business and you've had extreme lows. How do you deal with that as a creative professional? Because it's being an artist and being a creative in general is tough. But, you know, I'm just curious, how do you deal with it?
You know, I think you just have to have something inside you that makes you want to continue to tell stories so badly that, as I said before, that you're willing to subject yourself to the process. And I don't know why. Maybe it's a masochistic thing. You know, there are probably certainly better ways to make a living, but it's a compulsion, I guess.
I equate it to an illness. Is once you get bitten by that bug, I always say, I've said this a million times. It's like if you get bitten by the bug, you are infected, and it will never go away. It will flare up, and it can go dormant for 30 years. Because I got guys reaching out to me who are in their 60s, and they're like, "Look, I just retired, but I really want to do is direct." So and it's like. And I'm like, how do I start? You know, I've been a doctor all my life, but I really just want to tell stories. And I'm like, they got bitten. It was suppressed for 30 odd years. And now it's flared up. It never, ever goes away. And it's fascinating, that whole thing. Now, one of the films in your filmography that I think is not as, you know, not as known is 187. I absolutely loved 187. And when I was directing some of my directing work, I actually would bring in my DPs and we would watch 187, because some of the stuff that you did in that, with the color grading choices you did for the time was pretty, I think this was pre DI, right?
Yeah.
It was pre DI. So there was no digital color grading. So you were doing stuff in camera. So it was really remarkable. How did you, what guided you in your color grading choices in that film? Because it's pretty intense.
Well, I mean, coming off of Waterworld, as I said, which was not fun, I wanted to do something that was more experimental, where we could just really take a lot of chances, you know, creatively. And God bless him. I mean, it was Mel Gibson's company, Icon, that came to me with the project. And I have to say, you know, Mel's had all kinds of problems. So, but he was maybe the greatest producer I've ever worked with. He could not have been more supportive and nicer, you know, in the way he let me make that picture. He was wonderful. And so we were able to take a lot of chances. And I brought in a young guy named Erickson Kaur as DP. And we just went to town. We looked at every scene as an opportunity to do something different. You know, from color grading, we use a lot of swing and tilt lenses to shoot in the frame, where some stuff's out of focus and some stuff's sharp. Mm-hmm. And there's a sequence where in a classroom, we wanted to show one of the characters like on a TV, like on a TV.
TV monitor.
TV monitor. So Erickson went out and bought a Fisher-Price toy camera, and that's what we shot it with, and then took that image and translated it to film. And so we just did a lot of stuff like that, and it was really exciting, and it was really fun. It was invigorating, and it just kind of rekindled, you know, a lot of creative energy that I'd lost doing Waterworld. That picture didn't do any business, but I'm very proud of it. Sam Jackson was great.
That was his first starring role. Like his first, like, you know, he was the leading character in it. Like it was.
He'd done Pulp Fiction already.
But it wasn't the Sam Jackson show. Like he was the star of that movie. Yeah.
And I like it because, I mean, you know, Sam has sort of a persona that everybody knows him for, and he really sort of went against character. In that role. And he wanted to do it. He came to us. He wanted to do it. And I'm like, great. And he was wonderful to work with. He's a total pro.
Now, there was that one scene, by the way, in 187, that deer hunter scene. How did you approach that scene? Because that's intense. I just rewatched it the other day. Such an intense scene.
How do you
like directing a scene like that? Because both those actors, both Sam and I forgot, Clifton. They're just two juggernauts in acting. How do you direct a scene like that?
You know, I still remember the day we shot that. There was so much energy on set. I mean, everybody was amped up for that scene, really amped up, and everybody. I mean, not just the actors, but all the support personnel, the camera, everybody. It was great because you could just see everybody kind of sitting back delicately and watching it unfold and trying to be supportive, you know, in their own way. I mean, from makeup to effects, everything. Everybody was really into it, You know, a lot of times when you shoot, sometimes people don't care. They just kind of show up, do their job, leave. But everybody was really into that scene. And you feel it. You feel it. And it really imbued the moment with that energy. And that's why you do pictures, is for those kind of occasions, you know, mm-hmm. kind of energy to experience that.
That's awesome. And there was one film in your filmography that I absolutely just adore, which is Count of Monte Cristo. Absolutely adore Count of Monte. My wife and I just watched it, I think probably like 2 or 3 months ago. We watch it every few years because it's such a wonderfully obviously the story. Dumas did okay. He's all right. He's all right. But I'm going to give you all the credit. No. But it's such a fantastic story. And the way that the actors and Richard Harris and Jim Caviezel and Luis Guzman, I mean, just so brilliantly done. What about the revenge story, in not only in cinema but in literature, is so satisfying? Why do we love watching that? Because obviously I think Count of Monte Cristo is the ultimate, just wonderfully constructed revenge story. What is it about it that just draws us in?
Everybody has things that go on in their lives that they'd like revenge for. And so they can sort of vicariously appreciate someone who managed to get it. And that's why I think people empathize so much with characters who've been so wronged, mm-hmm. turn the tables on the people that have done it to them. Because I think everybody feels like I've been wronged in some way, and I would love to do that too. And I think that's why it's so appealing to an audience. That was a tough one. I mean, Jay Walpert, the guy that did the adaptation, did a really fine job. He changed a lot of things. And there are a lot of people that complain because they say, well, this film is not the book. It's not. And my attitude is, it can't be. I mean, the book is 1,500 pages long. It's like, how long did it take you to read the book? And they'll go, well, it took me a week. And I'm like, yeah, well, we didn't have a week to tell the story. So we had 2 hours. So necessarily you have to compress and combine and do things to try to keep the spirit of it. You know, it's just of necessity. And so because of that, you're going to leave a lot of people's favorite moments out.
Of course.
You know, everybody's different. Well, you left this out or you left that. Yes, I'm sorry. But we had to pick and choose because, as I said, we only had 2 hours. The screenplay is 100 pages, 120 pages. It's not 1,500 pages. So, you know, of necessity, that's what happens when you take a novel and turn it into a film.
And then you also did the Hatfields and McCoys, which you reunited with Mr. Costner. First of all, I loved it. I saw it on the History Channel when it came out, and I was just like, this is awesome. How was it just working with an old friend, I guess, back again?
It was great. I mean, you know, we had a shorthand. You know, we knew each other and could communicate in a way that you can't always communicate with other people just because, you know, the past and the relationship and all. But that was Hatfields and McCoys. That was a special production. It was a great cast.
Oh, Bill Paxton. Oh, God, he was amazing. Bill Paxton.
And I have to thank, you know, Fern Champion, who was our casting director in the Hubbards, from Hubbard Casting in London, you know, put together a fabulous cast. Everybody was good. And that was what was great. And it was another one of those shows that you hope for. I mean, we shot in Romania with a Romanian crew, and they were so eager and so wanted to prove themselves. And they were just wonderful. And it was everybody really got into it and wanted it to do well. And it was a real team. And, you know, I'll always remember that one fondly. Yeah.
And one thing to be said, I mean, obviously you've had your up and downs with Kevin over the years. When I saw you guys get back together again for Hatfields and McCoys, I was like, okay, they're working together again. Is there something to be said about just getting older and just, you know, figuring things out? Because there's things like I'm older. But I'm not, I'm not older, let's say. It depends what you say. I'm getting into the weeds here. My daughters think I'm ancient, so there you go. They're like, Daddy, when Titanic came out, it was 97. Was that before you were born? I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ. I wish it was – I was born in 97. but how – just as a director, the things you do as a young director – You age, your filmography changes. There's things that got me excited in my 20s as far as storytelling is concerned that I wouldn't even think of doing today because it's just not the kind of stories I want to tell. How can you talk a little bit about that whole process and then just also working again, like we talked a little bit about it, but just like understanding the maturity of an old friend, regardless of the ups and downs of relationships.
Yeah, you evolve, you know? I mean, like everybody does. As you get older, you kind of mellow in a lot of ways, and things, as you said, that were extremely important to you 30 years ago aren't so important now, and you have more perspective. And that enables you to approach things, I think, in a more objective way. The downside is, I think there's a lot to be said when you're young of being kind of young and stupid and enthusiastic and blindly going into things and finding stuff out of your own stupidity. You lose that as you get older. Mm-hmm. You know, you do kind of rely on experience more. And so it's a balance. It's a balance of trying to realize, okay, it's important to remember the prior experiences and to not repeat mistakes, but at the same time, be open to new experiences and new ways of doing things to just keep yourself fresh. Otherwise you get ossified because God knows things change, especially in the film business. I mean, it is so not what it was when I started today. It's completely different. Completely different. It's always evolved. I mean, look, you know, 100 years ago, we're doing silent pictures. Mm-hmm. It's always evolved. I'm a little disturbed by what it's become now. I'm sure I sound like a geezer when I'm talking about how, you know, well, when I was doing it, you know, it was much more exciting and we didn't do it that way. And it changes. It changes.
Yeah, no question. And it's changing now by the month. Like every month there's something new happening because of what happened with what's happening with COVID and all that stuff. But up until the 80s, really, the business hadn't changed a whole lot. Like it was pretty
– The 90s.
It was the 80s – when VHS showed up. When VHS showed up, that started the change.
It did. It did. But I mean, you know, even the 90s, the studios were healthy. We were still shooting on film. Mm-hmm. The attitudes of the agencies and all had not really changed that much. People saw it as a golden time and anything was possible. There's a lot of fear now. There's a lot of fear because things are not as lucrative as they once were. Sadly, I think theatrical cinema is dying. You can pretend that it's not. And you know, God bless Chris Nolan and his... You know, and his adherence to film as a medium, I mean, real film, mm-hmm. but it's going away. You know, the digital age is here and you have to be flexible enough to realize that technology changes and this is the way it's going to be in the future. And theatrical is just it's dying. There will still be showcase pictures out there. But in terms of the way the vast majority of the public consumes their content, that's forever changed. And it's going. It's streaming inside the home. That's where it's going now. And I don't think we're going back.
Now I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all my guests. What is the one thing you wish you could tell your younger self?
Ooh. 25 words or less.
You can go 26.
That's a tough one. Boy. I guess be more flexible. Be more flexible.
That's my answer is always be patient because it's not gonna happen as fast as you think it's gonna happen. You it did. You actually didn't move as fast as you thought it was gonna happen.
Yeah, I mean I've had a great ride and you know nobody does it perfectly. And yes, there are things I wish I'd done differently. Mm-hmm. As I'm sure everybody does, but I've been incredibly fortunate, you know, to get to do the things that I've been allowed to do. Because there's so many people that would like to be in my shoes and have the same opportunities and they're not able to. So I'm extremely grateful for all that's been handed to me.
Now, what advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
(Clears throat) It's tougher than ever. It's the toughest job in the world. Dimitri said, but don't let that stop you, because you have to take the attitude. If somebody says, look, only 1% of people make it in the business, succeed, you have to approach it and believe that you're that 1%.
It's insanity.
But it's insanity. You may not be, and the odds are against you, you know, but you have to believe you're the guy that's going to make it, because if you don't, you won't. And you will get ground up and you may get beaten down, but if you're going to try to do it and you want to go down that path and even have a chance at making it, you have to have that attitude.
I want to say one thing I always tell to people, and I want to see what you think about it. I tell these young filmmakers coming up all the time, I go, look, I want to prepare you for the realities of the business. I have a lot of shrapnel, different shrapnel than you, but I have shrapnel from 25 years of being in the business. Yeah. You're going to get punched in the face. I don't care who you are. Everybody, anybody you look up to in the business, from Spielberg to Nolan to Fincher to Kubrick, everybody got punched in the face, not once,
over and over.
And I want you to be prepared for the punch, because a lot of times I see these young filmmakers who have these stars in their eyes. You know it. We all, I was that. You had those stars, and I mean, to a certain extent as well. And they don't see the punch coming. And when the punch comes, sometimes it knocks them out for good. Like I said earlier, I want them to be able to take that punch. And then maybe as you get older, and I think you would agree with me, occasionally you learn how to duck.
You do. You get smarter. But it all goes back to, as I said originally, you have to be willing to subject yourself to the process.
That's a great point.
That's what you have to do. And you have to realize, as you said, you're going to get punched repeatedly, and you'll get up and you'll get blindsided because you won't be paying attention because you're focused on what you're trying to do, and you'll get hit again and you'll get knocked down, but you have to get up. And that's the career that you've chosen if you're going to do this. It's a battle royale every day for the entire career. And you have to ask yourself, am I willing to do that? Is it worth it to me? Do I really want to tell stories badly enough to subject myself to that? And if the answer is yeah, then do it. If you waver and if you're not sure, don't go down that road, because you'll be destroyed.
And last question, and arguably the most difficult one, three of your favorite films of all time. Three that come to your mind right now.
Right now. I always say this because the one I remember had the most profound effect on me originally was Dr. Zhivago. I've always loved David Lane, but I still remember how that picture made me feel. And I guess maybe the second one is probably 2001, Space Odyssey. And then the next two that immediately come to mind, probably Bushcats and Sundance Kid, and the fourth one, Badlands, Terrence Malick.
Yes, Badlands. Those are just good choices, sir. Good.
That's off the top of my head. There's lots of them, but those four.
I can go down a Kubrick rabbit hole with you anytime. Jesus. But Kevin, thank you so much for doing this. It's been an absolute pleasure and honor talking to you and talking shop with you. So thank you for enriching my life with your films over the course of your career and for everything you do, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's fun to sit down and to relive these things with someone that can understand.
Thank you, my friend. I want to thank Kevin so much for coming on the show and sharing his filmmaking journey with the tribe. Thank you so much, Kevin. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/445. And if you haven't already, head over to ifhacademy.com and check out the new courses we have to help you on your filmmaking journey, like Jim V. Hart's Screenwriting Masterclass, my film distribution blueprint on how to make money and sell your film in today's current marketplace, the Indie Film Producing Masterclass with Suzanne Lyons, how to raise money, how to pitch investors. There's so much stuff there. You got to check it out. Head over to ifhacademy.com. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.